Our world is built with stories.
Sometimes these stories cause suffering by pulling us apart from ourselves and each other.
The Liturgist podcast helps people love more and suffer less by pulling apart the stories that pull us apart.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Liturgist podcast. This is Michael Gunger. Today's show is on womanism, and Dr. Hilary McBride and William Matthews and I are talking to Nikki Black, who is a radical womanist, an intersectional feminist, creative mother, writer, and scholar. And I think you're going to get a lot out of this episode. We're in the last few episodes of season six here, and I can't wait to tell you about what's going to be happening next season. It's the biggest, most ambitious thing I've certainly ever been a part of, and I can't wait to tell you more. But this season, we're wrapping up these last few episodes, and I'm so happy that Nikki Black could be part of this closing of this season, because she brings the fire, and I hope that whether you know anything about womanism or not, you'll give this a listen and let it into your heart. There's a lot of good stuff in here. Okay, hope you're all well. Enjoy today's episode.
I remember being in first year university and encountering feminism in a new way. I had heard the mutterings of it around my home. My dad was deeply involved in feminist psychology and the intersection between mental health and the oppression of women. And it was in my first year university that I started reading feminist writers, reading about feminist thought, and really starting to develop my own relationship with the movement. And I came across the work, of course, of the second wave feminists who were advocating largely for women's right to work outside the home. And I was thrilled about this idea that, or perhaps floored by it, that it hadn't always been that way, really starting to wake up to inequality. And I remember having a conversation with my professor, one of my professors, who said, "Don't you understand the limitation of that facet of the movement? Don't you understand that class and employment and race and socioeconomic status are all deeply woven into each other? That disability can't be separated, that race can't be separated from this push for employment for women?" And I remember feeling perhaps struck that I'd missed this. And this professor went on to say, "You're missing something important about the work of equality. If you're missing that a community, an entire community of people, particularly Black women, were not advocating to work outside the home. They had been forced to for generations in slavery. And that they and their ancestors had been exploited." And so there's a discrepancy between the feminist movement and this call to examine culture as it intersects with gender. And that really blew open this identity for me of a more complex way of understanding the person and oppression. I understand the privilege that I have in having to learn about that in a higher education context and what the limitations of that are for me and not having learned about it sooner. But that really began my interest in reading womanist writers, understanding a more complex way, as I said, of understanding the person, but also of this movement towards liberation. So I want to toss it to you, Nikki. I'd love to hear your thoughts on womanism. What is womanism? That term might be familiar for a lot of our listeners and foreign for some of them too. Can you tell us how you understand it and why it matters?
Yes. So when I think of womanism, I think of it, I contextualize it with feminism, or put it up next to feminism, because feminism is an easy reference. Most of us know what that is, or have an idea of it, or have heard the term, and may even have some feminist values, whether we acknowledge them or not. But whereas feminism tends to really just always compare women to men, womanism doesn't at all. Womanism is women loving women. That is specifically and exactly what it is. It's about women's relationship to other women, specifically Black women, and our relationship to each other. And so when we're having conversations within womanism, we are not really addressing men. We are not factoring them in, really. They're not a part of the conversation. That's not to say that they're not important beings within society or within the family structure or, you know, whatever community we're in, but that's not what the conversation is about. So womanism, you know, we'll talk about addressing the needs of the most disenfranchised, most marginalized, oppressed person. Womanism will address reproductive justice. Womanism, you know, is conversations about how we're caring for each other and how we're, you know, what we're doing within our communities to, you know, see to it that everyone is taken care of.
What you articulated there feels like the exact thing that feels so compelling to me about womanism, and the idea that it is what you are for, not what you are against. It is mm-hmm. who you are caring for, who is being remembered, where the care is going, who is being centered, and not this idea of kind of performing your way of being in a way to replicate who has been given the most social mm-hmm. power. Mm-hmm. But rather yeah. how to be in connection in a way that is life-giving. It reminds me of the principle of shalom, truly, this sense of orientation towards wholeness instead of the deconstruction of what has been fragmented.
Absolutely. I love that you put it that way, too. It's about changing the conversation from what is lacking and redirecting our attention to abundance, really. And cultivating an abundance mind state and seeing how we can lift each other up from the bottom, actually. So an example that I always use when I'm talking about womanism to help people understand in this age of the plant parent, you know, most of us have plants in our homes now. We're getting into that. And it's this beautiful, you know, connection to the earth and bringing something living into our home and all of that. And I think a lot of us are learning how to care for plants. But one of the most basic things we understand about caring for our plants is that you water them at the roots. Now, mm-hmm. you know, some plants like humidity and want to be spritzed, and a little spritz is nice. It's cute. You know, you want to clean the leaves and everything. But if you only ever missed your plant at the top, you're going to get a dead plant at a certain point. Consistently, in fact, you want to put water at the roots, because if you put water at the roots, then your plant is going to be able to get nutrients and thrive. And so that is actually the way that society works. We have been tricked and lied to when we have been told that there's a trickle-down system, that if we take care of the billionaires and the rich people, they can make jobs for us and they can do this for us, and they will reach down into the depths of the despair in society and pull people up. That's not the way that it's never worked that way. It's never worked. But what we do see, you know, specifically like, social science has shown us, there have been studies, it's not even a theory. You see it in the world. When women are cared for and taken care of in a society, then the whole community starts to thrive. This works with loans. This works mm-hmm. with food. In every possible way, if you feed the woman, you're feeding the whole nation, and a nation will never rise higher than its women, ever. So, you know, if you want to boost the economy, Give women education, give them access to birth control, give them, you know, you'll start to see things take a turn where there may have been some lack there. And when you give women loans, that money circulates within their family, it circulates within their community, it helps everyone to thrive. And so that is the way, that is nature. And everything works from the bottom up and from the inside out. And so focusing on, as I was saying earlier, the most marginalized, the most disenfranchised, the most vulnerable people in society, when you take care of them, you take care of everyone else. Another example I like to use a lot is, you know, homelessness. If we said everyone is going to have a home, like homeless people, you're getting homes today, then what does that mean for me? That means I have a home too. That means that no matter what happens, I'm housed too. Even if I am not affected by homelessness, taking care of homeless people actually benefits me because I know that I will always have a home. If we say everyone gets food, no matter what, everybody's going to eat, then that means that I will always be fed, even if I am rich, because at the minimum, I'm going to get some food. At the minimum, I'm going to have shelter at all times. And then when people know that, when they feel valued, when they feel cared for, when they feel loved, it legit boosts morale. You're going to motivate me, you know, to, I don't know, maybe take more pride in, you know, my community and maybe be involved and care for the environment. More so if I have somewhere to live, but if people are literally stepping over me as they walk down the street, how does that help me to feel like I need to do anything? I don't need to contribute anything because I'm not even being humanized. I'm not being cared for. You see me sleeping on the street and you're stepping over me. So womanism addresses that. It says, hey, we're going to look around this room. And we're going to see whose voice we haven't heard. Mm. And we're going to look for the person that ain't nobody thinking about. And we're going to pass the mic to them. We're not actually even going to talk for them. We're going to just give them the microphone and let them tell us what they need, what they would like to see, and what we should do. Because if you take care of them, then you take care of yourself as well.
Mm-hmm. Hearing both you, Nikki, and Hillary talk, which is so brilliant and so beautiful, it really reminded me of something or some lessons that I learned pretty early on in life, and it relates to women. I feel like as a young boy, I saw early on this principle that women are unto themselves. I had strong examples of women in my life who didn't need men to take initiatives. In fact, I saw women organize amongst themselves, or like as you're talking about how women care for each other and center each other. I feel like I saw that. I saw it in church groups. I would go with my mom to, you know, choir rehearsal. I saw it in women's groups. I also saw that men and women at a young age were very much invested in different realities. Men oftentimes seem so invested in control and power, and women felt invested in people and tenderness and love and care and concern. I saw that as a young boy, pretty early on. I mean, when I was young, I read, I Don't Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, or I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings by Maya Angelou, and recognizing that women have an internal dialogue that is apart from men. those types of things really showed me early on the inherent importance and value that women carry apart from men. So hearing you both talk about that is just really solidifies for me how important women voices are, how they need to be centered. I'm wondering, for you, does womanism How does it reach for collective liberation? Is it simply just as you're saying when it comes to giving the mic to the person in the that isn't talking? Is it caring for the homeless and the poor? How does womanism compared to feminism reach for collective liberation? Are they reaching for it in different ways? Are they reaching for it in similar ways? What's the difference? And I guess Hillary can talk to that too. I'm really intrigued. How does womanism change the world? How does it make people suffer less?
I'll jump in with a little bit, to speak on some of what you were saying, actually, William, about organizing within the church, because womanism is Black woman centered, is something that we invented after we invented feminism, because we also invented that. We brought that to the Americas with us, and it allowed us to endure chattel slavery. It enabled us to take care of everybody's children but our own sometimes. It allowed us to take care of each other. And it's a movement that we were excluded from because of racism and kind of pushed out of. And then so you saw the birth of womanism after that. And so when we talk about the Black church, the Black church is an important component in this story, because it's an often overlooked fact, or maybe it is intentionally ignored, that the daughters and the granddaughters of formerly enslaved people had already secured the right for women to vote in the state of Illinois 4 years before the 19th Amendment.
Wow.
We already did it. That is actual fact. Go look it up. And the reason why that happened was organizing in the church. So our push to vote stemmed from our desire to get into the pulpit and preach. Mm. And that's where it started. And then when you look at the second civil rights movement, because it was a first one after slavery was abolished and then Reconstruction, there was a civil rights movement in there that people kind of forget about. So the civil rights movement of the 1960s was the second one. And women were central to that movement. And the Black church was central to that movement. But what the civil rights movement did was secure rights for everyone.
Yeah.
It wasn't just for Black people. It was for everyone. Similarly to, to bring it to modern times, the Black Lives Matter movement, for instance, which can easily be labeled as a womanist organization or ideology because it was started by three Black women, queer Black women specifically, too. That's also important to note. Identity is important in these conversations. And that was a result of, first of all, this is these women making noise about these men being killed, even though Black women are also disproportionately, murdered by the police and vigilantes as well. But the catalyst for that movement was Trayvon Martin. And so, you have these women that started this movement to say that Black lives matter. But honestly, truly, once again, if a Black life matters, then that's going to mean that all the lives can matter.
Yeah.
Because the Black is the ultimate other. And so we're trying to make sure that we're not out here in these streets just getting killed, for no reason, so that you can be safe too. Because in proportion to population, white people are killed by the police just about the same or more.
Yeah.
So what we're saying with Black Lives Matter and a movement to stop police brutality and extrajudicial killings is stop it. Stop. Stop killing everybody. This is not okay. Because at the foundation, at the core, this is a human rights issue. And we are saying that life is precious, and value my Black life, and then all of the lives will be, valued equally.
I'm so glad you mentioned Black Lives Matter, because you know, as you know, that organization has pretty much been labeled in this country in particular, has been labeled as a terrorist organization by too many Americans. But also, you know, in the light of the George Floyd shooting, what we began to see was a real outward attempt, particularly by many white conservatives and religious conservatives, was to say that you know, we support, you know, Black Lives Matter as a theory, but like we don't support the organization. And that became like a real talking point. It's interesting that you talk about those three Black queer women coming from a womanist foundation, because truth be told, you know, you go look at their website and their organizing principle, they're not centering, you know, heterosexuality and straightness, and they are centering alternative families in their movement. And everyone instinctively interprets that as, well, they're anti-family, they're anti-man, they're anti this, because they're saying, hey, no, we're in this movement space, we center queer people and queer people who are doing this work, because we know once when we do that, if they're taken care of, then everyone is flourishing. But you kind of speak to this
absolutely,
as like, I think there isn't like a mishearing oftentimes when people think of these movements, whether womanism, BLM, they often hear what's not being said, you know, maybe explicitly, rather than what's being implicitly said by just the very notion of their existence, that Black is the ultimate other, at least contextually from a global perspective. Black is the other. It is the bottom rung of every nationality and society. It is darker yep. the skin color, yep. the more hated you are. And that's a yep. global reality. So when you talk
that's about, just facts.
That's just facts. So when we talk, and we talked about that in the anti-Blackness episode, you know, but like when you lift those populations up, then it inherently means everyone is being fed. Everyone's being taken care of. Everyone's getting their life today and not getting shot by the police. And I don't know if it's a messaging issue, but I definitely feel like they mishear us when we choose not to center anything that is dominant in the culture, and particularly in this instance, it's women, to choose to center Black women or queer women.
I don't know if it's a messaging issue, because I feel that the message has been very clear. I think that it's an intentional misunderstanding, a commitment to misunderstanding this thing that is very clear. And it's just by virtue of the fact that historically, the Black body has been objectified and commodified and is for mistreatment and is for exploitation. It is like the very foundation of this country and its wealth is the commodification of Black bodies, the mistreatment of Black bodies. So like you can try to say that ideologically, like we are moving away from that. And now we understand that Black people are also people, but there was a time when Black people were not people. And that wasn't that long ago. So even if you understand in your mental mind, as my friends and I like to say, that, okay, that's not a thing anymore, epigenetically, do you understand that? Like, like in terms yeah. of your monies, do you understand that? In the yeah. same way that I have traditions and habits and mannerisms that were passed down to me from my great-great-grandmother that I don't even know, because it just came down, those same feelings, sentiments, attitudes have been passed down, whether you consciously understand or accept it or not. So then when the property start talking about don't treat me like property, you're going to have a problem with that. And also when you've been centered in all of the conversations, oh, the family is the nuclear family. It's a man and a woman and two children and a dog. And that's what a family is. And that's all it is. And that's what's been raised up for literal centuries. Then when someone else goes, excuse me, I'm a family, me and my same-sex partner, or me and my child, and I don't have a partner, or me and my grandmother, whom I take care of, you know, all of these things are a family. Mm-hmm. But when we take your shine, oh no, you don't get to be the center anymore. then all the movies are not about you anymore, then it feels like an attack. It feels like something is being taken away, because the very concept of racism, first of all, the very concept of race we know is not a real thing. That is a social construct. And furthermore, race is something that the people that are othered within it didn't even have any input on. No one consulted Black people or Latinx people or Indigenous people in the meeting about the invention of race. White people got together and invented race for the purpose of racism. It's not that racism came, you know, as a result of race. No, racism was the thing that needed to happen for financial gain. And in order to justify this, then I'm going to have to create science, whole science, psychology that still persists today.
Yeah.
It's still there. And so I have to create this whole, you know, process to categorize people to other people. And that is a profound, I was just telling my partner this today. I was like, "Woo, white supremacy. That was an invention. That was profound. That was deep. Y'all did that," because it has found its way into every single thing. And it hasn't missed me either. Mm. I was steeped in it too. So everybody got a dose of it, and we are still trying to extract it from ourselves. But while we're doing that, the correction that an organization or a movement such as Black Lives Matter is trying to perform is saying, hey, there are other people here too. There are queer people here too. There are transgender people here too. There are families that don't look like families to you. You don't understand that as a family, but it is. And we're all here, and we would all like representation, and we would all like to be lifted up and supported and cared for equally.
There's something that feels so Jesus-y about all of this. Jesus always like identifying and turning the spotlight towards the places that people didn't want to look. Say, I'm with, when you care for people in prison, that's me. When you, the sick, the outcasts, the adulterous woman, the prostitute, everybody that he was like shining a light on was usually people that the powers that be would tend to turn away from. So I'm curious, because, you know, most of our audience are fairly privileged people, not all, but as someone who's not a Black woman, how can we see the beauty of womanism? How can we let it in? How can we let it inform us and challenge us? How can we engage with what it would call us to do in a way that doesn't center ourselves, that doesn't come in and try to do what happened with feminism? How can womanism inform and inspire those who are not at the center of the conversation?
I think that, first of all, acknowledging privilege, but understanding privilege, because, you know, we it's a bad word. You know, people really feel very attacked when they are reminded of their privilege. And Michael, you were saying, you know, most of the listeners are fairly privileged people, but some are not. Hey, we all have privilege.
Yeah.
So that's step one. Mm-hmm. Like, I always come into conversations acknowledging that I have privilege. Where I may be put upon is my Blackness and my womanness and maybe some other things, you know. My mother is a disabled Black woman, you know, like I was raised poor, like, you know, okay, I have all of these these things that put me a few steps behind, several, many steps behind some other groups. Right. But I also have some things that put me some steps ahead. Mm-hmm. I have cisgender privilege. I have heterosexual privilege. I have the privilege of family. I have education privilege. I can go on and on. I have able body privilege. Yeah, yeah. I have, that cisgender privilege is a thing that I feel like that deserves a whole conversation, because not only do I get to be a woman, but I get to prove that I'm a woman too, because that's, you know, when we talk about feminism, there's a lot of stress on, once again, women's proximity to men and also our value as women, or what we have to offer, quote unquote, as women, and reproduction and all of that, to the point where we start to exclude trans women because that whole conversation. So I have all of those things going for me. And I think that when you want to truly utilize a womanist framework, you have to come into the conversation, first of all, with that and saying like, okay, I have these things in, like I was saying earlier, looking around the room and saying, okay, who here can I pass the mic to? Is there someone who, you know, doesn't speak English as their first language? Is there someone here? And how can we meet the needs of those people? Because I think that womanism focuses on equity and not equality. And that's another conversation that people get all kinds of confused within. Woo. And people think that like it's about equality, and it's not about equality. It's about equity. It's about meeting people where they are. So we can say, you know, we had the meeting at such and such time and everybody was welcome, but was there a ramp to get into the meeting? Were there translators in the meeting? Was there someone doing sign language in the meeting? Like, you can't just say, hey, it's here, it's available, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. So when I'm looking at, you know, maybe it's a project I'm doing, or maybe you have an opportunity to be a part of an organization or an event, look at who's invited. Look at who's on the panel. Look at who is in leadership. Look at who is not in the room. And as a person with privilege, it is your time to say, okay, guys, we don't have an interpreter here. Or we're supposed to be talking about XYZ subject, but actually the people that could speak to this better than any of us are not here. Why? You know, especially and particularly when you have clout in your industry and, you know, you command a high rate and people want you to come to their thing, you can actually say, I'm not gonna come.
All this has me thinking about this theory that I learned. I'm sure people who've taken a psych class have heard about Maslow's hierarchy of needs. We talk about it colloquially a lot now, but at the top of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, we see something called self-actualization. And what most people don't know is that towards the end of his career, he expanded or wrote more extensively about how self-actualization couldn't happen without community care. It couldn't happen without an attention to whoever was invisible, whoever had the least amount of power, and that there was no way that a self could become fully whole without the returning of resources and attention to anyone who was made invisible socially. And we don't think about that. We don't talk about that in Maslow's hierarchy, but it reminds me too of what you're saying, Michael, about the Jesus-y part of all of this. Like I've got a couple womanist quotes that I have stuck on my laptop screen that often return to before and at the end of my clinical days. And one of them is from Alice Walker. It's connected to, it comes right before she says, womanist is to feminism as purple is to lavender, the famous womanist quote. But before that, she says, a womanist is committed to survival and wholeness of an entire people. Mm. That this is the orientation of womanism, to be a before wholeness of everybody. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, when you were talking, William, about how does this orient us towards the undoing of suffering for other people, I keep thinking about Audre Lorde's work and the famous essay she wrote, The Master's Tools Will Never Dismantle the Master's House, and how this is a way to say that if we are going to be towards collective liberation, we cannot just know what we are against. We have to know what we are for and how, and we can't do it in the same way that the oppression was created. It has to be different. It has to look and feel different. And this is one of the quotes I have that's on my desktop here, or on my behind my screen. Audre Lorde in that essay says, for women, the need and desire to nurture each other is not pathological, but redemptive. And it is within that knowledge that our real power is rediscovered. It is this real connection which is so feared by a patriarchal world. Then she goes on to say, interdependency between women is the way to a freedom which allows the I to be, not in order to be used, but in order to be creative. This is the difference between the passive being and the active being. So when I think about Audre Lorde's work and how womanism orients us towards collective liberation, it is to say, not only what are we for, but how will we be together? And is relationship, is nurturance, and is the attention of that nurturance towards who has been made invisible and who has been fragmented by our society, the thing that is orienting us towards the world in a way that we are active in our being? Or are we participating in systems that hurt us and other people because it's accessible, because we've been trained to? Then what will it cost us to be moving towards this kind of liberation? But also, what do we lose when we don't? Mm. What do we lose when we are disconnected from the relationality that's wired into us? It feels, the more you talk, Nikki, like womanism is the natural state of being when a human is whole. Mm. That it is a movement that returns us collectively to who we are created to be, and not the continued and ongoing performance and kind of training that we've been given in these cis hetero patriarchal post-colonial settler colonial contexts that strip us from each other. It's relationship. And I think we can do relationship with our money. I think we can do relationship with our vote. I think we can do relationship with our theory, but I think we can do relationship best with our neighbor, the person that we have learned to not see, and with the people in our lives who embody a radical difference from us, that we have learned through our society that we have inherently more worth than, that actually being in relationship with them is part of us becoming whole and us recreating a social fabric that is relational, inherently relational.
I love that relational piece so much, because there's an element of like the self-righteousness that can happen in contexts where like you start talking about the poor, the oppressed, those people. There can sometimes enter that sort of conversation a hierarchy and an elevation of, we're going to help those people and those, you know, that I have run into that a lot and have experienced that a lot myself. Of like you think you're doing good work. You're like, oh, we're going to go to Africa and we're going to fix this problem. And then you realize in the midst of this like arrogance that you didn't realize you had going into a situation, understanding you don't understand what's really going on. And the relational piece, this like the sense of connection, I think that's so vital, because it's so easy to like snatch the off of the surface. Like, okay, turn your attention towards the poor and the oppressed. And then you see at how many like big white evangelical Christian conferences did I go to years ago where they started, it was like all of a sudden kind of in vogue to talk about the poor. And so it's like, okay, well, now we're going to include the poor in what we're doing by taking up this special offering or showing this video or whatever. And there was some aspect of it that always felt like not quite it, right? Like it's, but this feels so much more, I'm just hearing both you, Hillary and Nikki, talk about the spirit of womanism in a way that is like deeply connected. It's actually fostering the connection that is real between who I'm considering to be the oppressed and myself. Like it's actually like getting rid of that distance as opposed to solidifying it with righteousness and like, oh, I'll throw them a few bucks so that I kind of ease my conscience. Or now we've got a black person on the panel now, so great, we're involved in liberation, you know, like it's easy to just kind of snag some of the foam from the surface and think that you're now you can ease your conscience and think you're the good guy, but you're just kind of actually concretizing some of the separateness that has created the problem in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that relationship piece is so important. I'm gonna invoke two non-womanist sources. The artist formerly known as Mos Def, what he said in a song, I can't remember the song, but he was like, you know, people often ask, where's hip hop going? And he says, in order to understand where hip hop going is, I have to ask myself, where am I going? How am I doing? And Tupac said something very similar in an interview. Years before that, he said, people ask, like, how is the community, or asking questions about the community. He said, I'm the community. It's me. So you don't have to ask how they are doing over there. How are we doing? Which is why a lot of times when I talk about society's ills, things that I did not create, things that I am not necessarily supporting or feeding into, but that are happening, I will say, we are doing XYZ, because I am not, you know, by being present and maybe not doing everything that I possibly could have done to prevent this from happening, you know, or whatever, change the course of the situation, then I'm participating. I'm here too. And so it's like that the African principle, Ubuntu, which is, We are together. We are the same. There is no me without you. In order to be a person, you have to be in community with other people. I don't get to be a person without you. So that relationship part is very, very important and central to womanism. And it's been said that The Color Purple, the book by Alice Walker, the iconic book by Alice Walker, is a womanist text. And there's so many demonstrations of womanism in that, one of them being sharing information. A good friend of mine by the name of Ebony Janice, who is a womanist scholar, talks about how when Nettie learned how to read, Celie knew how to read, because Nettie would take everything that she learned and go and share it with Celie. If I have something, we have something. I'm not going to have information and you don't have it. I'm not going to have resources and you don't have it. We have it if I got it. And the way that we've been socialized, particularly in America, I can't necessarily speak on socialization everywhere around the world because I am not from there. In my close to 40 years here in America, and in my study of our society, it's the exact opposite. It's if I got it, I got it. And maybe I'll share it, probably not. If I do, it's socialism, that's bad. But I do like having a fire department to come and put out the fire at my house. But, you know, so getting back into that relational part and humanizing people is so essential to utilizing womanism as a framework and evoking the spirit of Fannie Lou Hamer, who said that nobody's free until everyone is free. So it's not enough for me to just labor for my own liberation. If you are still in bondage, then I don't get to enjoy my liberation until you get some too.
And Nikki, I think where I want to take that, and I'm sure it's been said by other people, is then when you are liberated, I get to experience the joy of that too. Like the two sides of this. And I think Alice Walker has spoken so well to this, like not just suffering and pain, but also strength and wholeness. Like there is the complexity of the human here. What this movement invites me into is not only is your pain my pain, but your joy is my joy.
I get to share it. When I see people get their freedom, yeah. I am so happy.
That's right.
You know, when I see other countries, other groups get a win, that means I'm closer to my deliverance as well. And mm-hmm. also, you know, so I think that's a really, really beautiful component. I think we're always focused on, yeah, what the struggle is and centering the struggle and decentering that struggle and changing, you know, the narrative is really, really powerful because hope is a major component of womanism.
Hmm. I am just so in awe of you, Nikki, but I'm also in awe of Black women because, truth be told, out of everything that I've ever in my lifetime read, studied, heard about, I really only hear about much of these things from the bottom up, from Black women. And there's something to the narrative that Black women, particularly in the Americas, have worked through and suffered through that I really think is a healing lesson for the globe. One of my favorite Black feminist authors, Brittany Cooper, you know, she actually blew my mind a few years back when she talked about how so much of the academic world has been centered on the universal man. Who is the universal man? And the way she talked about it from the academic lens was, you know, most of academia is sitting and trying to use the perspective of white heterosexual men as the template for how everyone else should live. And they have created this template and then tried to put everybody, and this is the force of colonialization, trying to put everyone into this box of like, this is the universal perspective, you know, the way we have objective truth in this way. And the way we think of the world in this way is how everyone should. And this is the best for everyone. But Brittany Cooper talks about something so profound to me. And it kind of calls on Michael's reference to Jesus, in which she argues that the people on the bottom, if anything, are the archetype for the universal man or woman. Because their suffering gives them a unique perspective to see everything in its reality for what it is. You know, Malcolm X says the most disrespected person in America is the Black woman. And he said, if you want to know what's real, talk to the ones who are catching hell. Like, talk to the ones at the bottom. If you want to see reality, talk to the people who are suffering the most. And again, it's the Jesus thing, right? Of like, of you want reality, you want truth, then hang out with women, hang out with sex workers, hang out with the poor, hang out with the sick and the leper, right? And so I think there's a shift happening, and I'll even dare say part of the image and representation of having a Black woman like Kamala Harris ascend to the vice presidency is this image of Black womanhood in being centered and being seen as powerful and being in the room to make the decisions, coming from the background and the perspective that only Black women could have. And I think we're in this great reversal, and we're beginning to be, where we are starting to see ourselves. I'm not a Black woman, but I am learning how to see reality through the lens of Black women. And that's not the script that patriarchy taught me. That's not the script that maleness taught me. It didn't teach me to see women as it taught me to be different from women. It taught me to be above women. It taught me to dominate women. But what I'm learning, just I feel like later in my life, is actually how to humble myself and hear, see, and listen to Black women on a whole other wavelength. Because when Black women talk, they're talking about our collective liberation.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think, thank you for bringing up Kamala Harris, because that is an this is historic that a woman would hold that position. And yet we still have very far to go.
Yep.
Because when we talk about privilege, this woman still holds lots of privilege. Yep. So we're still, you know, it's and people, you know, they will see this as an accomplishment. They're elated and they think that this is where it ends. That's what the problem is, that is always where the conversation and the struggle stops. Instead of understanding that this woman, you know, has class privilege, education privilege, you know, that she is not actually even the descendant of United States enslaved people. Like,
no,
let's have a conversation about that. And the way that in some ways, then she is safer, you know, that she is biracial, you know.
In the same way that Obama was, yeah.
In the same way that Obama was, when we talk about, you know, yes, her family being a part of, her family on her mother's side being a part of a social structure that has caste, but where were they at in that caste system? So, you know, we still have a ways to go. But yeah. I think that it is really, really a beautiful time for us to start understanding our relationship to one another. And another thing I was saying to my partner the other day was the Biden-Harris campaign. I was like, how amazing is it, though, that like his entire campaign was about like decency and just being kind to each other? Like that's kind of that's kind of what the platform was. It was like, hey, be kind, be neighborly, care about each other. And 2020 has been a year that has broken a lot of people open, that has actually killed people. 2020 has been a rough year. And so a lot of people would say like, that's kind of scraping the bottom of the barrel. Like that was your campaign. But the return to that as the conversation, like morality, character being important, and how we interact with one another and be in community with each other. I think hopefully this is, you know, a tipping point for us, and we can sit down and look at each other and say like, hey, yeah, how am I showing up in the world? How are we showing up together? And what can we do collectively to leverage our privilege, our resources, and take care of us, not the other, but us, all of us.
Well, thanks for listening to the Liturgist Podcast, everybody. This episode was edited by Tejas Lehrheiden. Thanks to the patrons for making what we do possible. If you'd like to join the Liturgist community, go to theliturgist.com. We'll see you all next time.